Hey Lobster, today we're looking at 10 Rules for Life by the Red Skull. Hey Lobster, today we're looking at 12 Rules for Life, Jordan Peterson's latest book, Beyond Order, rules number 7 and 8. Work as hard as you possibly can at least one thing and see what happens. And make one room in your house as beautiful as possible. But before that, there's some very important business to address. That is the fact that Dad just got called a Nazi.
Couldn't have said it better myself.
I'm quoting William, in fact, with that remark.
What a weird week.
Without further ado, I'm your host, Scott, joined today by William.
Hi.
Pat.
Hey, yeah.
And Jason.
Hey, let's do some epic.
So, yeah, I'm sure by now you've all heard about what happened, but in case you haven't, there's a Captain America writer currently who decided it would be a good idea to model the villain Red Skull, you know, everybody's most hated Nazi supervillain of Captain America comics, and model him completely after Jordan Peterson as some kind of conservative right-wing podcaster. And if you think this is ridiculous and you don't know what I'm talking about, I'll give you time to Google it. It's Captain America number 28 by Ta-Nehisi Coates. So,
this guy was a professional comic writer?
Professional is very, very loosely. But yes, he is a seasoned comic book writer, I would say. I can't really
paid
say
for
that
what he's doing.
I can't really say that he doesn't know his comics. I mean, like, I read the issue. There's a few Easter eggs in some of his work that only a real comic book nerd like myself would catch, but you know, this goes beyond anything that I expected would get thrown at Jordan Peterson, if I'm going to be honest. Like, to put it in Jordan Peterson's words, you know, I've been called a Nazi before, but never a magical super Nazi. So, like, what do you think about that, really? What can you say about that?
Well, the idea of, you know, taking responsibility, cleaning up your room, and, you know, making a room in your house as beautiful as possible is Nazism now. So, forget responsibility. I guess we have to be like Captain America now in this era. But, it's ridiculous. And even though I haven't read any comic books in a long, long time, I can definitely see the absurdity growing from this, and even the memes that are coming out of
The memes are great. The memes are fantastic.
Yeah. And, the one thing that I've learned in this era that we're living in is if you can't reason with idiots, make fun of them. So,
yeah. And I got to be honest with you guys, like, the amount that I admire Jordan Peterson and the amount that I admire Jack Kirby and Joe Simon, I mean, I was really rattled by this. I was seriously, like, it was not sitting well with me. It was bothering me. But when I saw the Hail Lobster campaign on Jordan Peterson's Twitter and, you know, Michaela's Instagram, it changed perspective for me entirely. And, like, the fact that it was all going to charity, the proceeds, it, like, lifted a burden off of, like, Will, you had a point to make.
Can you just fill in, like, because I didn't know, and you filled me in a lot on the origin story of Captain America, and I think it would be a value for all of our audience paying attention if you could inform them on why it's so offensive.
Right. I think what you're referring to is the fact that when Joe Simon and Jack Kirby, the people that wrote and illustrated Captain America comics back in 1941. Now pay attention to this. March of 1941. If you know your history, you know the Americans didn't enter World War II until December 7th, Pearl Harbor. So it's important to know that, you know, I always state it this way, that Jack Kirby was fighting the Nazis before the American military was. And then when the Americans did enter the war, Jack Kirby, Joe Simon, and also someone else who they give co-creator credit to, named France Herron. He was the guy that co-created the Red Skull. He also, all three of them, enlisted in the military to go fight the Germans. And that is a big reason why they're such big heroes of mine. Not only are they like such incredible storytellers and myth makers and responsible for creating the basis for all of the content that I love, like reading comics these days. Like, I love Marvel. I've always been Marvel over DC, even. When we talk about Vertigo, it's a different story, but, you know, I...
Shut up.
we were just talking about my three favorite superheroes. They're all Marvel. Hawkeye, Spider-Man, and Thor. I can't get enough of this stuff. Jack Kirby is such a personal hero of mine, and the fact that they took his legacy and they made him into Jordan Peterson, of all people. Like, you couldn't think of anybody better to model a magical super Nazi than Jordan Peterson. I mean, come on.
I mean, the fact that Red Skull is a Nazi and represents, like, absolutism and authoritarianism, and he's this, is he like a dead person that's alive?
No, well, when you read Captain America comics number one, it's a guy with a mask. Like, they, like, oh, he's just some guy, but, like, he also wears this big swastika on his chest, and he's running around in a big red jumpsuit, and it's like, he's very clearly, you know, a Nazi doing Nazi things, and he's wearing a mask to try to get away with other things. But, like, you know, the magic of comic books is nothing ever stays the same. Like, you can't believe anything you read in one issue, because it can all get changed in the next one. So, like, the original, like, in the first comic, Red Skull, he's later outed as, you know, just a fill-in for Johann Schmidt, who is part of the Inner Circle, who is a direct right hand of Adolf Hitler himself, and later becomes, like, retconned again as the head of Hydra. But, like, Hydra doesn't come along until the 60s, I'm pretty sure, or at least he's not associated with Red Skull at the beginning. But it's really hazy, but any iteration of Red Skull you find, he's got a swastika on him somewhere. If it's, you know, Max from the first one, or if it's Johann Schmidt that we all know from the first Avenger. But, like, the one in the movie is a little bit different from the Johann Schmidt in the comic continuity, too. So it's kind of hard to explain.
Pretty unredeemable across all of the eras, though.
That is the point of Red Skull. Like, he's this satanic figure. Like, he's into, like, Aryan race, like, really whack stuff, man. Like,
but, well, I mean, yeah. What I was trying to say is that taking a bad idea, this idea is just like a tumor, you know? Because Jordan Peterson talks about hierarchy in biology, because he talks about hierarchy in society, he's supposed to be made out to be like the ultimate absolutist authoritarian Nazi. I mean, it just doesn't jive.
Yeah, but, like, it's one thing to make that loose comparison, but it's another thing to so closely associate your character with everything Jordan Peterson has said. So, like, I feel like when I read this comic, he wants little kids to pick it up and see, oh, the Red Skull is the one who has, you know, the 10 rules for life, and the Red Skull is the one that talks about chaos and order. The Red Skull is the one that talks about the feminist trap. do any of these things sound familiar? But then when they put all of that in there, they throw in something so heinous and disgusting, I had to take a double take. Because, like, there's one panel where it just shows, like, you know, the face of Red Skull and, like, all of his, like, points in, like, this podcast that he's presenting or whatever, like, that all of these children are being exposed to and running off to join the skeleton crew. That's Red Skull's army. But,
good name.
Yeah, it puts the 10 rules for life, it puts the chaos in order, it puts the feminist trap, and then it really sneakily puts in Carl Luger's genius. And, like, goddamn, that's a sneaky fucking move right there. I'm sorry for swearing, but that is sneaky. Like, to associate, like, three things that Jordan Peterson has said, like, the feminist trap, I'm sure I've heard Jordan Peterson talk about that before on multiple times, you know? The myth of white fragility, it's... Some of his points can be a little controversial if you just take it at first glance, but just to throw in Carl Luger's genius to make it look like, oh, you're modeling after Jordan Peterson, this guy who just loves anti-Semitism, just loves it. Because, like, Carl Luger was one of the guys that Adolf Hitler pretty much emulated and wanted to, you know, restore the German state the same as he did, like, super Catholic. And there was, like, a couple other points, like, in the comic associated with Red Skull, and it's, like, what Bismarck knew, and it's talking about Otto von Bismarck very briefly, and then there was another label that said barbarians at the gates. I'm like, there's another Jordan Peterson quote. Like, what are you going to do when the barbarians are at the gates?
And, I mean, to be objective on it, if you look at what Jordan Peterson's done with his life, he's a clinical psychologist. So he's trying to help people or families. And then he has these projects that ultimately his goal seems to be to make the world a better place. You know, so it just doesn't add up.
He's talked about authoritarianism throughout history and just warning a lot of people about it. And as well as referencing several books on, you know, various massacres that occurred throughout history and saying, well, you know.
The problem is, it's like, if I disagree with you, you're a Nazi. And that's what this is, right? Like, it's that sort of, I don't know, is it a fallacy? What is it? It's a weird thing that happens now. And
if you come up with a rule, you're a Nazi.
Right, and so the
I would label it,
like,
you were looking for a word, I would label it as just lazy thinking.
Well, that's because you're ticked off.
Yes.
But the problem is, like, the Red Skull also was trying to make the world a better place, right? Like, all authoritarian, like, dictators, you know, at some point are trying to make the world a better place, but they have a terrible methodology. And so when you say that Jordan Peterson is that, you're using that as the extreme to say that he's a Nazi. And in spite of the fact that he's trying to make the world a better place, you disagree with everything that he's doing to try and go about doing it. If you're that smart to think that far. And hopefully, you know, theoretically they are. And that's just really rude. You know, like burying three truths or one lie inside of those three truths, the Carl Luger's thing. Like that's a slap, like the gauntlet's been thrown down. Yeah. And
them's fighting
Jordan words. Peterson's response was to say nothing and to not sue him for defamation, which would be incredibly easy because that's a pain in the ass. And it's stupid and it deserves no attention and no recognition. And it's embarrassing. And the sad part is it's in the engine of Marvel. So it will get all of the recognition and it will have all of the damning effects that you're talking about. Theoretically, but you know, you're also expecting a population of teenagers to look into things and you know,
ain't nobody got time for that these days. Ain't nobody.
Well, then maybe it's a good time to talk about the book. that we're reading.
I have one more point to make. Where there's a quote from Red Skull in this book that I was like, wow, that quote is actually just unfinished. That's kind of funny in a way. Because he says, I offer you the sword of manhood. That's the Red Skull quote. And I just scribbled in my notes. I'm like, Jordan Peterson would finish that quote with, now keep it sheathed and rule the world. So that's what I would have to say about that. But yeah, let's try to segue into the book now, because, you know, after all, we are a book club.
What was that seventh rule again, Scott? Because I think you were killing it there in the application of that rule.
Okay, what was rule number seven? Work as hard as you possibly can at least one thing and see what happens.
Nailed it. I'm saying that you brought some good awareness to this whole Red Skull issue for 15 minutes, and you fleshed out a whole bunch of good points and gave some information.
Yes. I feel like I could keep going for hours, but, you know, that's nerd rage that I don't have to dive into anymore for today, you know. 17 minutes, 15 to 17 minutes, that's enough, you know. Why don't you take us away with one of your points, Jason?
All right. So he opens up rule seven with talking about heat and pressure and the formation of diamonds from coal. And this really kind of reminded me of Dzogchen Buddhism, where the idea is that a clear mind is like a diamond mind. That's how they describe it. And the diamond is reflective. It's signifying brilliance and focused consciousness, right? And in a diamond, you have inclusions in it. So things that make it less clear. And I kind of saw that as like the three weeds of the mind. I'm always talking about those, like greed and hatred and delusion make your diamond mind less clear. So you're not as reflective. And I don't know. I just like this. I like that comparison. Ultimately, I think what he's talking about in this chapter is the necessity for rules and how to play the game of life.
Another thing to add on is a quote that he kind of, you know, metaphorically mentions, which is, to wear a diamond is to become associated with the radiance of the sun, like the king and queen whose profile is stamped on the sun-like disc of the gold coin, a near universal standard of worth. And that to me is just shows that if you want to, you know, shine a brightness on whatever it is that you're trying to show, it's, you know, it's always best to just, you know, try to build something that's new to you, that's something that you came up with, and try to make that as unique as possible, and let that grow out. And the more it grows, the more value it is, essentially.
Yeah, I missed that part about the king and queen, but that's a good metaphor, because throughout this book, he's talking about how we start, you know, life as the beginner, the fool, and we work our way towards mastering something. So the queen and queen kind of represent that mastery that you get if you're invested in life. If you genuinely invest yourself in life and try to, I guess, work as hard as you can at something, and at the same time, like, knowing what the rules are and how to break them, it, knowing when it's okay to break them.
So we go back to Hermione. A return to Harry Potter.
Of course. You can't avoid it at this stage in the game.
So, since reading this chapter, I have studied what is required to go through the process of getting a university bachelor's degree, and we've been discussing it a lot with, like, you specifically, Jason, you know, in your epidemiology degree, if you don't mind me saying so. And, you know, there's specifically this notion that Jordan Peterson has that, you know, you have to get educated to the highest level. And I think Scott and I were having a bit of a banter, maybe contrary to that belief system. And so I'm having a hard time sort of rectifying that gap because, you know, as you know, as I've mentioned, I dropped out of university and I didn't work hard. And in fact, I kind of hate working hard. like, I would rather get as much result out of the least amount of effort I can possibly get away with. And so, it doesn't really mesh. I'm having a hard time here, boys. Help me out. Like Albert Einstein says, never memorize anything you can look up. We're living in an age of weak technology, cell phones in our pockets, and the kind of paradigm shifting world that we're entering makes me wonder if this whole work as hard as you possibly can thing is the right sentimentality.
So at some point, I believe it's in this rule 7, it may be elsewhere, but he says you have to have skin in the game, right? And so when I went to university and got my bachelor's degree, I also worked part-time and it was difficult. Then I went on as the recommendations by my professors to go on to work on a master's degree. I worked part-time there as well, but I also took out a significant amount of loans. That's the skin in the game that I took. I still have about, you know, $120,000, mostly because of interest in loans that I'm working to pay back. And I work a government job because of the, you know, some benefits there. But you're right. Some of the tools that I gathered along that path, they were muscles that haven't flexed since. And so they've atrophied. But the thing that I've gotten from the degree is almost like a key to certain doors that I can open that other people don't have that key to. Is that key worth, is that a diamond key that's, you know, worth over $100,000? Apparently.
It's, for me, it's not even like monetary value. It's just the pressure of the debt that's mounted on afterwards. It's like, okay, you have to sell your soul for a couple of years so you get this one thing right now that may or may not be useful. I mean, I watched a John Vervaeke episode today that's kind of relevant because he talks about like the formulation, like the conundrum. Like, would you accept if you had a friend that told you I can make you a vampire, would you accept it? And then when you start to take that question seriously, it's like, okay, that's something that I don't have any knowledge of what I would gain or any knowledge of what I would lose at all in that transaction. And it's the same kind of question of, like, should I have kids or should I enter this long-term relationship? Should I commit? Should I, you know, this and that? But you just kind of,
Well, it's weird because money, when you have it, is a promise to yourself that you can do things in the future. You know, it's a promissory note. And then debt is almost the opposite of that. It's taking away from your future. So,
yeah, but it's almost like if someone just tells you when you're a kid, yeah, you go get this degree, but you're going to be in debt for, you know, the next 8 years of your life. There's no way for that kid to actually understand what that means. Is like the point I'm trying to make. Like, well, this knowledge that I'm going to acquire, I don't know what that's going to do for me and what I have to sacrifice, I don't know what that's going to hinder me with. Yes, Will.
Thank you, sir. Is what Jordan's saying, Jordan, we're on a first name basis now.
That's Dr. Peterson to you. That's the Red Skull to you.
Hail
Lobster.
Lobster. Go through the list. What one's acceptable for this? All right. Okay. Lobster. Sure. Yeah. If pressure equals diamonds, and then you have $120,000 of debt, and it's like, oh no, I have to pay off this debt. I have to carry this. It's so much pressure. If I don't carry it, I'll die. And it's like, you're forced to carry it. Is that the pressure that makes you the diamond? Is he saying that you need to carry debt to become better? Because if you don't have a burden that you have to repay, you won't experience the societal hierarchy-based pressure of the capitalistic society we live in that forms diamonds out of great men.
Yeah, like take up your cross and bear it kind of thing. But also in like the Nietzschean perspective, like whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
So is he saying like buy a brand new car, go to university and get out the biggest mortgage on a house you possibly can, because then you're going to become a diamond? Maybe.
I don't think he's saying that necessarily. I don't think that he would want you to make foolish mistakes and go into bankruptcy. So there's like a certain where there's the burden you can carry and then the burden that will crush you.
Yeah, well, 100%. Like, not to the end that it kills you, but to the point where it's like, I can barely carry it, but I can.
I think there's also a little room for, like, a warning against tunnel vision in this chapter. You know what I mean? Yeah, I feel like if you aim at one thing specifically, I feel like you kind of lose sight of everything else that you know is important. Like, it's okay to disregard some minor aims that you don't deem as important as the one, but I feel like if you just stay focused and tunnel visioned into that one goal, you might, you know, lose connection to friends and family. And you know, humans are social creatures, we need that kind of stuff. So I think there might have been room for a warning against that kind of excitement into it.
Well, here's the idea that I've been thinking of. The burden of carrying all that debt is to keep you alert about your suffering. You have to acknowledge that it's there every day until you can, you know, find the time to actually not only fix the debt, you know, reduce it as much as possible, but also subjugate yourself voluntarily to a set of rules that will transcend that burden and lead you close to whatever goal that you're trying to work at. And unless you have, you know, eight figures and you're able to pay off the debt easily, at what point can you allow suffering into your life? And you know, not so much as to put you down per se, I mean, sure, it is part of it, but allow it to say, hey, you got work to do. I'm not going to, you know, pressure you in this room forever. I'm not going to allow you to do that unless you want me to. Let's figure something out.
Right, the weight you carry creates a certain tension on your psychological makeup, if you will. It's like if your mind is a spring, that weight compresses it, and so you have to maintain some kind of tensegrity or tension. And I keep going back to this idea of like the struggling artist is typically the produces the best work. Like, has there ever been an artist that had no struggle? They had everything they need. And like Vanilla Ice, like who cares what he has to say? He's rich, you know. But like Amy Winehouse or somebody who struggled with addictions, like people resonate with that.
And fame can also have an a huge toll on that. And even Van Gogh, just going back to his life, you know, he only sold one painting, and he spent hundreds and hundreds of hours painting that he didn't make a lot of money off it. But
you know who else didn't make a lot of money off their art? Jack Kirby. He's paid like $10 a page for his art, you know?
$10 a page?
Yeah, like he didn't get any royalties, you know? There's a lot of controversy over comic book artists. But, you know, maybe they needed to be, you know, forced to work for their money, or they wouldn't have been as good.
Though I think some of these people, like Jack Kirby, may have been, you know, sincerely interested in the art. Of course.
They would have had to be, because being a comic book artist at that time was not making them good money. Like, and plus they were Jewish too, so like a lot of the old comic book artists, like, comic book art was looked down upon for a long time. Like, we're privileged to live in a time where nerds like me can walk about in free society and, you know, be prideful that I've read comic books. But, like, so back in the day, like, it was like the slum art, you know? Like, you were looked down upon. Like, you hadn't made it yet if you were a cartoonist for, you know, Timely Comics or, you know, National Comics or whatever. People didn't really respect them at all. It was the writers made some money, and then they paid the artists to fill out the pages of their books. They put the words in, and that's how they kept their business going.
Wasn't there a law that was passed in regards to, you know, comic books, or was it like the age range or something? I'm not into comic books that much, but do you know anything about that?
There was a moment in the 90s where, like, Jack Kirby was actually one of the biggest guys in getting artists, like, their original artwork back, like, the rights to their artwork back to them, because at first, it was just they drew the art, they mailed it in, and they never saw it again. They just got their money in the bank, and then their check in the mail, and they just kept working. But it wasn't until, like, the 90s when, like, if you know about Image Comics, like, guys like Jim Lee, Todd McFarlane, Rob Liefeld, they started a company called Image Comics, and they just did their own thing. And they're like, we're not getting taken advantage of anymore. Everyone that works for us, every artist is going to own everything they do. And, like, they weren't, like, Image still isn't really like a comic book company in the same way that Marvel is, because they just have imprints. Like, everybody just goes through Image to create their own work. And it's pretty incredible what they did. So they kind of paved the way, along with everything Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko, the original artist of Spider-Man. Like, they all kept... Yes, Will.
And so that's why we have comics like we got this week, right? Because they're not enduring bad times, so they're making bad art. And if it's easy to produce, if anybody can just contribute to The Atlantic and then start writing for Captain America, what worth are they going to get if they're not carrying the burden of the field that was there 70, 80 years ago?
Yeah.
But the path has been, as you've said, paved. So what diamonds are to be found?
That's a damn good metaphor. No, repeat that metaphor, man. The path has been paved.
So what diamonds are there to be found?
Oh, man. Yeah, that's a really good point.
But the second point is that not also the problem of social justice warriors? Is it's a question of focus of suffering, and they're focusing on the existential suffering of the world without any personal experience, which is the best form of knowledge of suffering, to make an impact. And they are not actually bearing the weight of the suffering that they put as their cause. So it's not pressure on them. It's just pressure that they're putting out into the world, and they're not becoming diamonds, and neither are we. And we both want to solve these problems.
Yeah.
But you can't do it if you don't pick up your own burden. So if you're not carrying enough, you don't get stronger.
They're creating tension in the world, but they want none of their own.
Yeah, here's a good point about that. Because, you know, when Jack Kirby and, you know, the entire history of comic books, from the 40s to the 60s to the 70s, 80s, and 90s, it's consistently been the counterculture. Like, Jack Kirby was advocating for war when no one else wanted anything to do with it at the time. So, like, it was pretty controversial. He was taking what they would have called a Jewish stance on the issue. Jewish in air quotes. Because, you know, it's just the sign of the times. But, like, nowadays, when you have the comic book writers, like Will said, Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote for The Atlantic. He's a social justice activist by all definitions of that word.
Well, forget the man, because that's all just ad hominem. The field itself, like, he hasn't created intellectual property. He hasn't had to. He hasn't had to have the burden of manifesting some form of beautiful, confusing thing and have it come out of him. He's just got a job and got paid really well for it.
Yeah, but, like, to continue my point, like, Marvel these days wouldn't say anything against the social justice or the woke narrative that, you know, every corporation on the planet is just spewing out constantly, nonstop. And when, like, it reminds me of, like, a little throwaway panel in a Vision comic from the 80s that I was reading recently, and he's just saying, "Hey man, I know it's not cool these days to be a liberal or anything, but I know one thing for sure, and that it's not cool to discriminate against people for immutable characteristics." Because he was talking about, like, people were discriminating against Vision because he was a synthezoid who wanted to live in New Jersey, and people were just not having that, and he was the one defending it. So it's just like, at a time where everyone was conservative, they weren't afraid to be liberal. But I haven't found a comic made in the past 20 years that wasn't afraid to say anything against the narrative or the current culture that we have. And I think that's dangerous when nobody wants to speak out. So that's why I'm here. Hail Lobster.
Well, you were talking earlier, Scott, about tunnel vision and what we should do, right? And there's this quote in the book where Dr. Peterson is saying, "The inability to choose among 10 things is to be tormented by them all." And right. And one of the kind of the key things of Rule 7 is he's talking about rules in life, the necessity for rules in playing games. You know, if you're a child and you want to play a game, you have to learn the rules and abide by the rules. But then later in the chapter, he talks about the necessity for a single interpretive perspective on reality. So that could be thought of as a rule. And then he throws in the Ten Commandments. And essentially, it seems like what he's saying is civilization needs a religion as that single interpretive perspective. But it opens up a whole new set of questions, such as, like, which religion do you choose? And
couldn't it just be like a terms of service for the whole world? Like, can't we all just agree to the end user license agreement for real?
The one that we all agree to, and then once accepted, nothing has changed.
Yeah, but, like, exactly. No, like, seriously, can't that be our government of the future? Like,
yeah, but
as a base starting point.
Hmm.
Otherwise, get out of the park.
I don't. I have something to say, but I don't know how to say it.
Well, this has been something that's, I think, been on Dr. Peterson's mind for the last 3 years, because
of course,
back in 2015, he released a video like it was called the Death and Resurrection of Christ, right? The commentary in five parts, where he talks about religion quite a bit. And he says he needs 3 years to think, you know, whether Christ is real. And then we get this book 3 years later,
where he's making the case that the resurrection was real. And, you know. Yeah. I've been doing nothing but defend Jordan Peterson this entire podcast. Now it's time to drag him through some mud.
I did that 2 weeks ago.
I know, but...
Even if religion is like the single interpretive perspective that the world needs, according to Dr. Peterson, which religion do you choose? And if you choose Christianity, which seems to be the case he's making,
yeah,
just look at all the different churches. They're all like infighting, and it doesn't make any sense. Well,
exactly.
If anybody should resurrect, it should be Abraham, and he should, you know, look at the landscape that's polytheistic in nature and make a new god. Or Moses. We'll get Moses to go up to him. Like, let's get a new Moses to unite all of the peoples under one new god. Reject everybody else's gods.
Let's settle on Jacob, because I really like that stuff that Jason found about the mystery of the patriarchs. But we'll get into that some other time. But in this chapter of Jordan Peterson, it really, like, this was Jordan Peterson, the evangelist, talking the entire time, I felt. Like, he actually, like, said the words that you have to embrace the dogma. Like, no. I don't see the utility in that at all. And he talks about, like, how the spirit is just, like, dogma that got old. And, like, I don't really see where he's going there. I really hit a wall with this chapter. I'm going to be honest with you. It's like he's trying to make the case that the rules in Christianity aren't arbitrary. Like, I disagree. I think they're arbitrary, but that doesn't mean I don't see the utility and the use for it. If you adopt the rules and try to become a good Christian, I don't see that as a bad thing. But
how do you see the Ten Commandments as being arbitrary? Do not kill. How did you find that arbitrary?
Well,
do not rape.
Number one, it assumes that our nature is evil, right? It assumes we want to do those things, so they have to tell us not to do that thing.
But wouldn't that level of assumption make it not arbitrary?
I think it's arbitrary because there's no proof or evidence saying that this combination of rules, this set, this absolute guideline is the answer. And that's what I don't like about, you know, these people pushing religion on everybody, where they say religion is the answer, Christianity is the answer. I'm not saying that there's not something magical about the Ten Commandments, and that if you follow them, that's good
for you. If I may, I think you're saying the choice of the Ten Commandments is arbitrary, not the Ten Commandments themselves. Choosing Christianity being the arbitrary action, not so much the rule set. Because the rule set was based on, as we've read, you know, observation of culture and ritual and tradition and effective and ineffective behaviors. And there was a lot of thought that went into it. And if it wasn't, you know, divine intervention, that this man clearly had a good system for controlling a population, came up with a good set of rules, but the notion of choosing one of the existing religions is arbitrary, and I could get behind that. Like, you look at Islam, it's like their rules aren't much different.
Yeah, but they're all different sets. It's not the rules themselves. Like, do not kill is good, you know, each and every one of the rules you can take, and that's fine. It's the collection of them. It's the fact that you have the Ten Commandments in the order 1 through 10. That's the one you have to keep. that's completely arbitrary and is no less arbitrary than the Buddhist route, the heathen route, the Satanist route. I think they all work equally. Okay, fine. So
now for me to rebut what you said earlier, what do you not see the benefit in embracing the dogma?
Because it limits you way too much. If you say to yourself that, okay, there is a God, the resurrection did happen, I'm going to put myself in this church in which nobody else accepts any other contradiction to that. No one accepts any other argument against that. And you stop yourself from questioning what they mean and pursuing, you know, higher intellectual states. I think it's dangerous to put yourself in a box of Christianity or Buddhism or anything. Yes, Jason.
So I was listening to this TED talk on the necessity of play. And I know Dr. Peterson's talked about the necessity of play.
Okay, if you're going to tell me that joining church and believing in the resurrection and all the miracles is another game that I need to play, forget it. Forget it.
No, that's not what I'm saying. I don't think I'm saying that or I'm going in that route. But what I'm saying is as a child, rules are more fluid. You know, if you want to play a game, you kind of bend the rules a little bit. But then as you grow up, it's the limitations of the game that make it interesting. So if you play chess, no one wants to play with somebody who moves their rook, you know, any which direction. They want to play with a set definition of rules.
Can I interject? When we're playing the game of philosophy and thinking about the big questions, I want to sit down with everybody. I don't care what kind of rules they follow. If you follow the rules that, like, I have to act like a good Christian, and I follow the rules of, you know, I listen to my tarot deck in Star Wars more than I listen to my Bible or whatever, you know, that's fine. We can get somewhere with that, which is why I think, like, any kind of religious answer isn't going to work for us. Because like you just mentioned, Jason, if we have to pick Christianity, it's between Protestantism and Catholicism. And if you pick Protestantism, well, there's another 100 options for you. So it's not a religious solution that we're after. It can't be a religious solution that we're aiming at. It has to be a cultural one in which all religious frames are accepted and none of them are, you know, pushed on other people. I just want to learn about other people's, you know, faith and religion questions and then add to my own. Yes, Will.
But to build on what Jason's saying, I don't think he had any concern about faith or religion there. I think the notion was at a philosophical level, if you invoke the construct of rules in your life, then it could permit your brain to give you more enjoyment, right?
Yeah, I think so. It's this topic is something that people have killed each other over. So it's not like we're going to, you know, come to some sort of conclusion in our podcast.
Exactly, which is why I want it. I never want a religious conclusion. That's not a goal of mine. I'm a secularist. I want Christians, Muslims, atheists, Jews, and pagans, and, you know, everything else that I didn't list off to be able to sit at the same table and have this conversation.
The problem I have with secularism is it is still inherently bound to religion, right? Because it's unreligion. But what I like to discuss has nothing to do with either. Yeah, forget about religion, because that's not what I'm talking about. I don't give a darn if you're for it, against it, freedom of it. You know what I mean?
To be fair, I'm almost responding more to Jordan Peterson than to you or Jason.
Yeah.
But, like,
I agree.
It's a book club discussion, so I feel like these are the points I have to address first and foremost.
We've got the rules. Makes it fun.
And for our one audience member, book club, because we haven't gotten to rule 8 yet.
Oh, geez.
Amen. But so the idea of embracing dogma, not the specific Christian dogma, but the notion of being able to embrace a dogma would potentially lead to the structure that permeates throughout life to give it more meaning.
Yeah. Like, there's half
and,
of...
And I'm with you when you say tarot, right? Because that, if you create your mythology, if you create your dogma, if you create your festivals, you know, first of all, it takes a lot of groundwork, but it gives you benefits. Just as much as I observe April Fool's Day and May the 4th.
I feel like I'm rambling a lot, so I don't want to take up too much time, but there's just too much to respond to. And now I've lost my train of thought.
I say we move on to the next rule.
Try to make
one room in your home as beautiful as possible. And I think, you know, transitioning into that, maybe that is something that we all have to endure at least once in our lives, is to try to find something that's beautiful, or at the very least, find something that we find beautiful and then transcend it and then let it flow. And there's a section in Rule 8 where Jordan Peterson mentions a real piece of art is a window into the transcendent. And you need that in your life because you are finite to it and limited and bounded by your own ignorance. It is for such reasons that we need to understand the role of art and not think of it as a luxury of some kind. And to go back to what you were saying, Scott, about Jack Kirby and how the comic book industry back then was not very popular. It was Jack Kirby's way of expressing what he saw, what he was trying to understand with Captain America and everything. So that's the same way that when David Lynch was creating Twin Peaks, it's us trying to pick up something from our own unconscious and just try to dissect it and figure out what is it doing here and what can I do with this.
Yeah, he's doing something kind of interesting in this book too, that he, in one chapter, he's saying abandon ideology, and then in Rule 7 he's saying, you know,
that's an important point. Abandon ideology, then embrace dogma. But it doesn't make any sense to me. I just have to say this one more thing. When I hear embrace dogma, it sounds a lot like embrace limiting belief.
No.
Can you separate that for me?
I think paradoxes in life, but I'll let Will discuss that. I just wanted to mention that I think it's significant that right after Rule 7, where he's talking about the importance of rules, he goes into the importance of art, and
which by definition
is freedom of expression. There are no rules in art, right?
Right,
right.
So first of all, I want to start by saying Van Gogh is on the floor beside my power bar. I have just like a print that's laminated of a self-portrait by Van Gogh. So, you know, you can tell I'm valuing art.
You got your Van Gogh, I got my Kirby, and my Jim Lee.
Actually, if we want to get real, I've got this, which is a custom-made triple tarot card, Zelda-inspired beauty that I got made out of England by a company that changed the name, so I can't show them out because I don't know what their name is. 8-Bit Boutique is what they used to be called.
That's really cool.
Anyone who implores you to embrace dogma does so with the belief that the dogma that you're embracing can be believed to set you free. Because if it limited you, it wouldn't work and you couldn't embrace it.
I don't know if I agree. I don't think I agree with that.
What don't you agree with?
See, our audience have the luxury of being able to rewind and hear that again.
Anybody who says embrace dogma does so with the belief that the dogma that you can embrace is one that frees you and does not limit you.
Yeah, but it is my belief that every dogma comes with its own limitations. I think Nietzsche would say that.
All dogma has limitations?
Well, every
what
game
is a limitation?
Like, every game has its own limitations.
When you lock yourself in to Christianity, you're unable to see the world from a point of view of the pagan or the, you know, the atheist.
Like, okay, so here's my problem.
It's not something
I
can dive into and embrace and become and integrate. It's just not available to me.
Gravity is a limitation, right? You can't fly. Do you embrace gravity? Do you accept it as part of your life, as a law of the universe? Because that's the level of embrace that we're talking about.
I have,
because it's not, it doesn't become a conversation about limitations at that point. It becomes a conversation about the way things are that you accept them to be and perceive them to be. And it's not limitations, it's reality that you embrace through the dogma that you believe in.
Yeah, but I don't see the same reality as a Christian. Do you not
I'm
see
not
my
talking
point?
About Christians. I'm talking about dogmas.
No,
I agree
about
with you
the
that
Christian
the Christian
dogma.
Dogma is limited. The Christian dogma is limited. All religious dogmas that currently exist in the landscape today are limited. I wish I could believe in Christianity, but I don't, because there's things I disagree with. I want Jesus Christ, but slightly better. I don't want to jump in the pool of Christianity. The water is muddied. I want to jump in a pool. I want to slide from my pool. I wish the pool could be in space.
Well, it's almost, and I'm trying to tie this into the rule 8, that every artwork is limited because they're bound by the edges of the portrait, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And it kind of makes you think that all the art in the world is locked up in a museum.
Yeah, there's...
I'm having a great time, by the way. This is really fun.
Yeah.
That was, like, the one thing, like, the fact that all of the most valuable pieces of art are locked up in one museum, and Jordan Peterson doesn't talk about the will to power. That's another problem that I have here. Whereas, like, he calls it a fear of art, and I call it, like, I would say greed and the will to power has a lot more to do with these massive art collections than people being afraid of art. I really did like Chapter 8 a lot. Like, this might have had, like, a lot of my favorite parts in it when he was talking about, like, expression and everything. But when he started talking about, like, the museums hoarding art and people being afraid of art, like, I've heard him say that before, like, people are afraid of beauty, they paint their walls beige. They're like,
well,
I really don't see it. I don't think you're on to anything there.
I'm sorry to continuously play devil's advocate with you, Scott, but it's really good, like, this back and forth that I'm able to create because of it. So I think it's not that individuals are afraid of art, but that societies and governmental structures and machinations at a cabal level are afraid of what art would do to individuals, and so they hoard them in museums. Because what would happen, right? We've been having this conversation about what happens when you consume good flo-fi, what happens when you stop consuming bad gangster rap, and it's like, what happens if every city is beautiful, if our natural way of doing things, if our dogma of our culture was beautiful? What would it do to people? How could we control them if they were inspired all the time?
Right. And in Chapter 8, Jordan is talking about how he goes to his department head, essentially the god of the department. And he's like, I'd like to make my office look a little bit nicer with these artistic, drop ceilings and wood panels. And she says, no, we're not going to do that. And
that is a funny story.
Yeah, it made complete sense to me through the lens of the will to power. Of course, she wouldn't let Jordan decorate their office. The department head is the one with the nicest office. That's the arbitrary rule. That's but it's not their even that, dogma. Right? The people well, can't.
Yes, and it's not even that. It's like, that's just not the way it's done. Offices aren't decorated. It's not a question of could you,
exactly.
And I'm giving you permission. It's a, oh no, this isn't a discussion because that's not how it's done.
Right, they're committed to it, the dogma that all of the offices
but just as
shouldn't
much as
decorated.
They were probably victim to it, right? Before they were the department head. And to the degree that they don't have a 50th floor beautiful corner office with windows and a little pitch and putt in their office room, right? Everybody on the ladder suffers the higher rungs because that's the way it's done.
And I guess this is where the rebellious right. phase comes in for a lot of artists, which is they choose to ignore what other people tell them, you know, based, you know, whatever rules they have, and they decided to just do it themselves.
And so that's where we get to Jordan's rebellious phase, and I'm going to continue to call him Jordan. And he just decides to decorate his apartment or his office anyways. And it's like, now he's telling us about this story about this time when he was in a hierarchy where he had a superior who had a policy and they told him that he couldn't do a thing, but he did it anyways. And it's like, it was a really specific time that this specifically happened to him. And it wasn't a general critique of the institution and the policies and the way things should be changed at a macro level, but a micro example of the macro. And I don't know if he got to the point that this is like a societal dilemma that we're experiencing and that individual was not in control of the situation in any more capacity than Jordan was.
One thing I find really fascinating about this book is that it jumps between similar and disparate ideas between the various chapters. And so in chapter 8, he's talking about the land of possibilities. As children, we perceive a vaster landscape in front of us because there's all of the unknown. We don't know what lies out there. So our mind blows it up and it feels like anything could happen. And then as we grow up, those possibilities start to shrink down into specific limitations. And it's almost like this department head is just the embodiment of you know, an adult who's saying, no, we can't do that because it's outside of our limitations.
Yeah. Oh no, where'd my point go?
And well, maybe this might lead you, Will.
No, I got it. Hold on. Wait. Game theory, right? And resource expenditure. Because if you play Stardew Valley, like any other great game addict would know, you wake up at 6 a.m. and your energy bar is full and your health bar is full. And 1 minute in the real world is 1 hour in the game. And you're a farmer and you're running it and you got stuff to do. So you skip breakfast, you skip yoga, you skip meditation, you skip television, you skip bathing and you water your crops. And then you deal with your animals. And then you go to the market and you sell everything. And then you eat roots that you just pulled out of the earth. And only as much as you have the time left in the day to expend the energy that it will fill your meter. And you chop down some trees to get some wood so that you can get an addition on your house. And you do this every day. And you never go to the sauna. And you never talk to anyone. And that's how you make the most amount of money. And that's kind of what happens in business, right? Because in the age of decay that we live in, where all of the individuals in business aren't actually woke and acknowledging the fact that, you know, our house isn't our house and our vessel isn't our vessel. Like, that's not what we're aware of. But in business, I've got a list of everybody who's in the office and their names can get rubbed off the list, but the office is permanent. And we know that the office is permanent. So no, you cannot make permanent altercations to your office because you are a temporary member of a space that will live and surpass your time and your tenure here.
I'm just happy you said the words age of decay because that's where I wanted to go with it. Back to our conversation with Paul Vanderclay. Like, the world is perfect and beautiful and divine and limitless when you're a kid. And then when you grow up, it just slowly starts to decay.
I don't know if I put those two pieces together very well, but what I'm saying is when you play a video game, you spend the least amount of resources to get the maximum out of your time invested in the game, and you disrespect your character. And when you're in the game of business, the bigger the business and the more individual members playing on the team, the less individual expenditure of resources, because you don't need to expend resources on the member doing the thing. It's the thing and getting them to do the thing as much as possible that matters. That's how you get profits. Even though you might marginally get a bit more profits if they're happier, it doesn't really work out that way because time is ticking.
And that kind of goes into what I was about to say, which is beauty is something that you, as an adult, tend to forget, or at the very, you know, at the very worst, you lose it. And you have to let that beauty come back to you to remind you that it's something that will keep you going in life. There is lesser and greater value when it comes to beauty, of course. But the thing to remember is that beauty was something that you wanted to live with. And if you pass it on to somebody, like an employee in an office, who wants to, you know, maybe do something greater in the marketing department, let's say, you have to provide that kind of motivation to them and remind them how beneficial it can be for them to not only grow professionally, but also personally. And this is how, you know, a lot of artists like to express themselves, because, or, you know, when they're coming up with ideas too, is they're trying to solve whatever problem they had before and then try to bring it back. Or not the problem itself, though, but, you know, just that environment too, where they were trying to figure out and then establish what they think the answer to that problem is by, you know, putting on canvas or something, and or making a movie about it too.
The thing is, when an artist makes something beautiful, they're unpacking their unconscious, as you're saying, as Carl Jung would be proud to have us discussing, and they're putting their life into their work, and it's taking up their life. They're literally dumping their time and their energy and their mind into this piece of work. And when we observe art, we sacrifice willingly our own time, our own life. We spend a chunk of our time that we will never get back because we find it valuable. And we reflect on it later, sacrificing more time, because it does something that is completely different than most experiences. And that's why a healthy relationship is so wonderful too, right? Yes. Like the two committed individuals sacrificing their life and their time and accepting them for what they are and observing it and so on and so forth.
Yeah. I have a segue. It's important to have like art integrated into a relationship, but it's also important to have a good relationship with art. And when I say art, I automatically put like three things together, like music, visual art, writing, whatever, you know, woodworking, whatever you do that can be called a creative outlet, right? So what you have to have a relationship with that. And like, I've had a situation in my life where when I was in high school, I was like playing guitar or bass every day. I was constantly like in and out of bands and everything, like always trying to jam with people. And then I went to college. You know, I was like had one guy that played guitar that I was pretty close with. But after college, I really kind of lost that connection with other people. So I kind of like threw guitar practice and everything on the back burner. And when that happened, it was like I lost a part of myself and I didn't realize I was losing it. And then, you know, like I had to hit a hard reset at one point in my life, and I picked up the guitar again. And, you know, it changes your life once you can actually like have a relationship with your own creative self. And it also allows you to like objectively improve as well. Like you could say what you want about like the subjectivity of art, and like everything is beautiful if you see the beauty in it, like in the eye of the beholder, all of this and all of that, but you can still become objectively better as a visual artist if you hone the traits that you want to hone. Like, you know what you want to present. So just work on that. It can be whatever you want it to look like. It's all subjective, but you can always get better and hone how you want to present yourself. Does any of that make sense?
You know,
yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. But also, not even but though, and also, like, objectively, you know, in the world, there's art and there are artists and there are people observing art, and it speaks to your lobster brain. You know, in a year, are you the type of person who looks at art, who makes art, or not? Because the lobster brain is listening and it's determining how much serotonin you can have today.
Well, also, our lobster brain knows that the world's moving constantly. It's impermanent. And so Jordan Peterson talks about this one section in chapter 8, do not fall in the same pit twice. And from what I'm hearing or what I'm feeling is that regardless of the media of art, whether it's music or a painting or a poem, it gives you some sense of a footing, a grounding to stand on, where otherwise the rest of the world's moving around you, like in turbulence. And that piece of mental and I'm going to use the word loosely, spiritual peace that you feel inside when you embrace something beautiful, it allows you a respite. It gives you, you know, a temporary place to stand and take a breath.
And that probably speaks to the part of the brain that can imagine and fantasize and hallucinate and remember a visceral image, because the brain doesn't differentiate, right? Once you've attained a moment that you can recall of art, when you recall it, you get the same experience. And sure, the memory fades, and that's why you should make a room in your house as beautiful as you possibly can, at least one. But you should also visit museums and art and landscapes and beautiful vistas, because put that in your bank and you can recall it, and your brain will do glee and bliss and happiness and inspiration, and you don't even have to go back. You can save the entrance fee.
Practice observing everything around you.
Well, not everything. Don't look at some stuff.
Well, yeah. But if you have to, at least once.
It's gotta have some limits, Scott.
Oh, jeez. Yeah, but then he talks about how, like, artists inhabit this weird area between order and chaos, and how they can, like, bring forth this inner feeling that, like, when you look at it, you just think, oh, where did that come from? Like, that's how Jordan Peterson puts it.
Yeah, it's the raw thing in the back of your brain, and you think, what was that all about? Or, ooh, I didn't expect that. I wasn't expecting that to happen. You know, it kind of reminds me of, I don't know if, was there like any moment in a movie that any of you saw that kind of struck you by surprise that you would never would have imagined you would see in real life? Yeah, Will.
Hi, hello. My name is William. I recently decided to accept the existence of the sequential Star Wars movies. When those artists created that movie, you know, 7, and it opened, and it was Star Wars, but it wasn't made by the people who made Star Wars, but it was Star Wars. It was like, they did it right, and I didn't see it coming. Good job, thank you. This is wonderful. Hmm. And then, you know, singing, right? You can be hanging around a group of people who are actually singing, and then one of them gets the balls to like try something that might be in their wheelhouse, but they're not sure. And then they nail it. And everybody's like, oh, the secret sound.
Yeah.
It's like they're touching something divine.
Like, I couldn't tell you how many times I've been like jamming with someone and they just hit a note or nail a solo. And I'm like, didn't know you had it in you.
Chord. That pleases the Lord.
Yeah, that pleased the Lord for sure.
There was one quote that I got from Rule 8. It kind of stuck with me. And I somewhat paraphrased it, but essentially what I felt he was saying on page 224 of my book, that's the American Black Book, is he's asking the audience, he's asking the reader, you know, are we human beings or are we prey animals, cowering and protecting ourselves, hiding in camouflage? Everything changes, so keep in touch with your kingdom of God, your providence, or the ground luminosity, lest you die in boredom, ennui, arrogance, blindness to beauty, and soul-deadening cynicism.
Wow.
Heavy. Well delivered, Jason. Thank you for that.
I think he's calling out people like when we started talking about the guy who drafted this Red Skull as far in representation right. of Jordan. You know, he's calling those people out in their apathy, and I think you gotta find beauty in the world. You gotta play by the rules, and life's a paradox, and try to not take yourself too seriously. I don't know.
Yeah. I think the rules stacked well together. I think the book builds on itself. I think there's some serious stuff going on that I don't fully grasp.
Maybe that's my problem. This stuff is just too seriously for me, and I'm just the kind of guy that doesn't take anything seriously.
too seriously, bro. Sorry. Oh.
It was what, around like Easter that we were reading Rule 7? Yeah, it all just kind of was quite heavy, and it took us probably 2 weeks to read through these two chapters and really to absorb it and in order to, you know, discuss it.
I still feel like I could go back to Rule 7 and, you know, if I reread it, I'd probably just get a whole different perspective of it. So I think I might have to do that soon. But Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, I definitely want to go back and read Rule 8 and just compare that chapter with various artists in the world who struggled and got their footing.
Yeah, really. For me, with Rule 8, it was so salient because, like, for me as an artist, it's just like, I wish I could write this as well because this is exactly how I feel. Thank you for telling everybody my perspective, Jordan. As a fellow musician, you know, I know he's a piano player.
Guys, it's my bedtime.
Yeah, I know. I've been... My little Red Skull rant took us a little bit into the over an hour mark. But there was one other part that I feel was really important that we had to go over just real quick, was when he was talking about the wildebeests in, like, this camouflage, and how when the lions were hunting the wildebeests, they're unable to, you know, focus on one of them. But as soon as they started marking the wildebeests, it gave the lions a target. So as soon as one was marked, that was always the first one that died. But when you look up in a crowd and all you see is a wall of wildebeest, you don't really have anything to aim at. Like when he was talking about the 100 things to aim at, narrowing them down to one thing. It was like that one little red tag that was on a wildebeest that was enough to give them dinner that night.
Maybe just for context, if somebody hasn't read this, it was biologists who marked the wildebeest with red paint. Right. And in nature, the only way for a lion to pick one animal out of the crowd is to look for some physical weakness. Right. You know, are they standing at the edges, or are they slower than the rest?
Are they limping? But it goes back to when we were rediscovering the etymology of individual. You know, like each of the individual wildebeests were indivisible from the crowd till one of them was marked and taken out of the crowd. I think there's a correlation we can draw there. With this?
If I'm going to make any point while I'm floundering over here, it would be that if you're telling me that Jordan Peterson is saying narrow down 100 targets down to one, and then also the only way to hit a wildebeest is to go for the limpy ones, the correlation that I draw is like, oh, should I go for the easy goals?
I was thinking more of it from almost from the point of view of the wildebeest, because like you'd be like, even like without putting the lions into the equation, just the fact that you have all of the wildebeests that are just together, and when they're together they're a squad. And when we learn about the, like, because that's when you brought up the individual etymology, Will, because you're the one that said, like, oh, that's what an individual is. Do you remember that?
I do, well, vaguely.
Well, it kind of ties into what he's talking about, like a single interpretive perspective. There's an artist friend of mine who did this photograph where it was just a bunch of rubber bands, but one rubber band was colored red. And so that one stood out. And so in the perspective of the wildebeest, the safest thing to do is to blend in. And that's what you do when you adopt a religion, you join a church, you're blending in with everybody else.
Right. So Jordan Peterson, over the past 3 or so years, was sticking out way too much, like someone put a red dot on a wildebeest. And now he's joining a tribe because he's uncomfortable with that feeling. That's my current theory. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Very easy conclusion to make. The premises may not be valid.
I mean, it's not the end-all be-all. It's obviously not every single factor. Clearly, I'm just... Maybe that's a part of it. Maybe that's a subconscious happening there.
Problem with theorizing on Chapter 8 is I'm going to make more theories by the time I get halfway through Chapter 9.
Exactly. So we'll do that in our next podcast. So do we have any other thoughts for these two chapters right now? So Will can get to
Hail
bed.
Lobster!
Hail Lobster! Oops.
My whole family is so pissed off at me, I'm sure.
Hail Lobster.
Go make art.
May the force be with you, everybody.
Do something epic.
Or you could just flow.